This podcast is sponsored by Cellar Plan from Berry Brothers and Rudd, collecting fine wines for future drinking.
Hello and welcome to the Spectator podcast. I'm Laura Prendergast, and on this week's episode, we'll be discussing whether marriage is becoming an elite institution. We'll also be looking at whether the Tories' glass is half full or half empty, and we'll be lamenting the loss of Britain's tiniest train lines. The royal marriage has brightened up 2017. But is marriage now the preserve of royals and the rich? This week's cover story looks at the new marriage gap and why weddings are out of fashion, but only at the bottom of the social scale. I'm now joined by Frank Young, head of the Family Policy Unit for the Centre for Social Justice, and Rosie Wilby, a comedian and the author of Is Monogamy Dead? So Frank, in Ed's piece, he refers to something called the marriage gap. Can you explain to us what that is?
Well, the marriage gap is simply that we have a situation in the UK today where there's enormous inequality around marriage, where broadly middle and high earners, those on around 43,000 or more, almost all of them get married, around 87%. For people on lower incomes, under £16,000, only 24% of those couples get married. So there's a huge inequality associated with marriage in this country. And that, in essence, is the marriage gap.
And why is that? What are the benefits of getting married if you are higher up the social scale?
Well, the benefits for middle-class couples are savings, essentially, in your day-to-day lives. I mean, you halve the costs associated with living. So there are huge economic pulls for marriage for middle-class couples on salaried incomes. For people and couples who are in receipt of tax credits and benefits, that doesn't exist. And there's what's called a couple penalty, which has almost the opposite effect. It costs you to couple, to commit to each other, to have a relationship and live together, whereas that doesn't exist for middle-class couples.
Rosie, you've written a book called Is Monogamy Dead? What do you make of all of this?
Well, obviously, when I was researching the book, I was very much looking at relationships that sat somewhat outside of our kind of normative narratives about relationships. And I very much campaigned for marriage equality along kind of sexuality lines. I'm a proud member of the LGBT community, where we've often had maybe different approaches and alternative ways of looking at relationships and the concepts of family, if you like. And there's a real sense of friends being family when people's biological family have maybe rejected them. The writer Armistead Maupin uses a phrase, logical family, which I rather like. And I feel that certainly in my peer group, the biggest threat to marriage, I'm not personally against marriage or for it, but I think the biggest threat to it is this idea that, and it's a relatively modern idea really, that it has to be a romantic construct and it's only available to two people, whatever their gender, two people who are in love. And we tend to understand that as having a sexual relationship, whereas I came across tons of people who were asexual or who had very fleeting and transient sexual and romantic partnerships, and actually their primary person in their lives, if you like, was a platonic friend or someone that they shared a house or flat with. And it was a different type of relationship, and we sort of don't tend to put those relationships on the same level. We elevate the status of romantic partnerships, and I kind of think the way we talk about marriage and the way we present Harry and Meghan in the media, and there's all this hoo-ha, oh, isn't it romantic? We sort of overinflate these ideas of romantic love, when actually romantic love, as we all sadly know, is a rather transient phase. Freud even described it as a temporary psychosis. And actually, probably, if we want marriage to last, it's probably got to be a lot more pragmatic than that, and really about money and resources and splitting the bills.
Frank, do you think that's fair, that there's a sort of pragmatic economic side to marriage that people often don't like to focus on?
I think the important thing about marriage is this idea of commitment. I mean, the essence of marriage, I mean, if you take away the term itself, and of course there's a big debate at the moment around whether civil partnerships should be extended to heterosexual couples, if you take away the wording around it, the essence of the act, if you like, is commitment. And it's that commitment that we believe has a dynamic effect on behaviour. We talk about dynamic effects a lot in welfare policy around things like universal credit and changing behaviour. Actually, the same is true, and there have been studies from the United States and elsewhere that have shown that there is a similar dynamic effect for couples who make that public commitment to one another, and that commitment to looking after one another, which is possibly where you get the improved statistics around mental health, around physical health, which are profound actually for couples who are married.
Interesting though that you seem to think or suggest that commitment is exclusive only to a couple, whereas I've met people in multiple relationships who are committed to one another in multiple arrangements. Obviously, it could require a lot more time and energy.
Would they be committed? Would that be a financial thing as well? Would they be kind of sharing?
Yes,
resources,
many people share resources, share a home, raise children together. I've spoken to now grown up children who grew up with polyamorous parents and who said it was brilliant because they just had lots of really happy, cheerful adults to play with them all the time and share all the domestic chores and tasks. So I too believe that commitment of some type is good for a stable society where we feel loved and valued and we feel able to give love. I think all of those values are really important. But I worry about this dialogue where we make it exclusive to certain types of relationships and that it has to be a couple format. I'm not always strictly sure that's true. I think the LGBT community have long pioneered alternative ways of looking at relationships. And what's interesting is gay male couples have tended, you've mentioned civil partnerships, the lowest civil partnership dissolution rates are for gay men. They have dissolved partnerships at half the frequency of lesbian couples, which is kind of the other way around from what many...
What's the thinking behind?
Well, the thinking behind that is that many gay men come to a very pragmatic arrangement to have a non-monogamous relationship, certainly as they get further into a committed relationship. And that seems to work for many of them very, very well, and they stay emotionally faithful. However, what's really interesting is the men that I know doing that tend to be sort of from 30s and 40s upwards, whereas a lot of younger gay men are sort of now adopting some of the ideas of monogamous marriage now that we have actual marriage within the LGBT community. And it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. But gay men have actually been very, very successful at commitment, albeit in a rather redefined way. And I think we slightly missed a golden opportunity to really redefine marriage when we had gay partners being able to marry. I think we could have really investigated the whole thing and perhaps renamed it like you're saying.
I suppose what we haven't talked about yet is religion, which is obviously has been did define marriage. How important is that in all of this, Frank?
I think in social policy terms, the religious aspect to marriage isn't the most important thing. It's really about the couple, and largely in UK terms, we generally are talking about a couple. It's what matters, I think, to them and in their relationship and the sort of commitments they're making to each other, to provide for each other. So the sort of religiosity around the ceremony perhaps is not as important as that sort of public act of making a commitment in front of your friends or your family or your workmates and so on. And if you think about it, we don't really do that in this country in any other sphere. It's quite unusual when you sort of unpack it that we have this ceremony, whether religious or not, where two people will actually spend an enormous amount of money in a lot of cases, whether advisedly or not, and stand up in a piece of theatre and make that commitment, those vows to each other. And that's the important element and not necessarily the church surrounding it.
You mentioned spending a lot of money. Is that partly why marriage is becoming sort of the preserve of the wealthy, because the only people who can really afford it are wealthy?
No, I don't think it is. Funnily enough, I think for all the time that we spend at the CSJ sort of talking about the importance of marriage, we're actually quite against the idea of big, lavish weddings, especially when couples, families can least afford them. I think if you're going to start your married relationship in debt, that is a very poor place to start indeed. And if you're living already in a low-income situation, that is a bad place to be. It's not the wedding itself and the money you spend on it that is the sort of factor here. There are two essentially for us. One is cultural, I think. One is that you have either seen married relationships modelled to you, or you haven't, and you have a sort of cultural expectation that this is something that you aspire to and is important in your life. And then the economic factors that as you alluded to at the beginning, for middle-class salaried couples, it makes a lot of economic sense on top of love and the sort of commitment to one another. If your income is largely social security-based, it doesn't. And in fact, it is costly to you.
Is there anything the government can do, though, to encourage people who are disencouraged to get married to actually want to get married?
Indeed, they can. I mean, the very first thing to do is to close this couple penalty. Firstly, to recognise that it is a factor in lower rates of marriage for low-income communities, and to use things like the marriage allowance, which David Cameron brought in, to some controversy, actually, target that perhaps even better down the income scale to help close that couple penalty.
So, Rosie, do you think it would be a good example to set to the country if Meghan and Harry had actually quite a low-key wedding?
Oh, definitely. Yes, to kind of change things up a little bit. It puts so much ridiculous pressure on us that we see these huge, lavish weddings, and it reinforces all these ideas about marriage and indeed any sort of long-term committed relationship having to be perfect. You know, if the dress has to be perfect, if he has to look perfect, if there's not hair out of place, then we all feel, as we have done for many years with the way celebrities are presented in magazines, that we must be perfect. And it makes us feel pretty awful about our real selves and also about our real relationships. So yes, it would be great to see them have a very sort of modest celebration. But I doubt that will happen somehow. I think it's going to be wall-to-wall television
coverage.
Even if
coverage. They wanted a modest one, they couldn't have done to hide.
Yes, but I think it would be a great message to sort of say, look, you know, relationships are hard. You know, all those romantic films always end with the golden couple getting together, and we don't really see all the petty little squabbles about who puts the bins out.
And I suppose actually Prince Harry knows, you know, from his parents divorcing, that actually you can have the big wedding and it doesn't necessarily...
Yes, I mean, he might not need to argue about who pops the bins out, but he will know that relationships are challenging. So I think it would be great to see that message that relationships are tough. You know, it's not all a fairy tale. I do sort of crave in many ways that stable society of people staying together in some way, however they demonstrate that commitment, and I think it is a good thing if we commit to our relationships however we decide to have them. It's just, I suppose, my ideas of how we have relationships and how we define those may be slightly different to the traditional norms.
I'd like to see Prince Harry and Meghan Markle embark on some marriage preparation and go on a marriage preparation course. I mean, these are...
What does that involve?
Well, that involves typically attending a session with a coordinator and talking about some of the really difficult issues that you're going to face in your married life and that we will all face in our relationships, whatever form they take.
Is this done through the church? Because I suppose the church traditionally... Would have done something like that.
Often it is. If you're going to have a church wedding, different faiths will have different rules, but if you're going to have a faith-based wedding, there will usually be some assistance on some degree of marriage preparation. But not exclusively. There are lots of charities out there who provide marriage preparation outside of the realms of faith. And the point is forcing you to reflect beyond your wedding day and the gloriousness of it and talk about some of the really difficult issues. Talk about babies, if and when they're going to come, what your expectations are. Talk about money. Talk about things like sex and things that are really tough.
Yeah.
And things actually that you might not have talked to each other about, but it, down the line, are going to cause you problems and will possibly cause you to then break up. I would really like to see Prince Harry and Meghan Markle attend a marriage prep session. I think that would do enormous good in boosting marriage preparation in this country.
Thank you, Frank, and thank you, Rosie.
What are you drinking this weekend? Start a cellar plan with Berry Brothers and Rudd, and soon you could be uncorking something out of the ordinary. To start your cellar collection, visit bbr.com/cellarplan.
In his column this week, James Forsyth says that if Theresa May manages to move on to the second phase of Brexit talks, a very different conversation will begin for the Tories, and they might start to even think about their own recovery. James joins me now, along with Fraser Nelson. So James, is there a more optimistic mood in the party right now?
Yeah, I think there was a feeling that Theresa May had kind of three trials to get through before Christmas. And if she could get there, she'd be in the strongest position she's been since the election. The first was to have the budget not unravel and not be a disaster. They achieve that. That might not be the greatest achievement, but the last two budgets have both unravelled, George Osborne's last and Philip Hammond's first. So it was something of an achievement. The second is obviously to get the Brexit talks onto the next stage, and the word today about the divorce bill apparently being settled suggests that she might well get sufficient progress in December and get on to trade and transition. And the third is to see Damian Green, her deputy and closest political ally, be cleared of personal misconduct. That looks like the most shaky of the three at the moment. Evening Sound have some more on these text messages tonight. But I think that if they can get the EU negotiation onto the next phase of a Tory rebellion, which they look like being able to do, she will be in the strongest position she's been in since the election.
Fraser, are you feeling glass half full or glass half empty about the Tory party?
Right now, I'd say the glass is about a quarter full, and that is substantial improvement to the minuscule drops of water that were in it after the general election. It's hard, actually, to have this conversation without realising how bizarre it is that we're talking about. The very survival of the Prime Minister is an achievement. The very fact that she's got the competence to give a budget that doesn't immediately unravel is an achievement. We are talking about this in all seriousness because of just how desperate things are for the party, which is very odd to be having this conversation given that they're in government right now. They've just recently won is exaggerating, but they recently had an election that led to their taking power. And they've got 4 years to adjust. So things are starting from a pretty low base. But that said, they've got a lot going for them right now. They've actually got the momentum of the Cameron achievements recently. They don't like talking about them, but there's still a bit of a year zero about David Cameron, that he never existed. But a lot of what he did is paying dividends in terms of employment and schools and welfare. And the fundamentals of the economy are pretty good. You just need a Conservative Party that knows what it stands for. The problem is it's not being given leadership. Now, Theresa May is not out for defining what your party stands for. And I'm reading Tim Shipman's excellent book right now about the debacle of this year's election. And it's clear throughout there that the election was all about trying to give Theresa May a personal brand distinct from the Conservatives, giving her a clear definition of what she believes Toryism should be. Now, because she fluffed that election, all of that has vanished. Nothing has taken its place and something needs to. The question is which Tories are going to come along with their paintbrushes to draw something on this blank canvas.
James, you mentioned in your piece also this next big thing, which is the Brussels meeting on Monday. What are we expected to hear from that?
So Theresa May goes for lunch with Jean-Claude Juncker and will basically put all the offers on the table. So the money, citizens' rights, this idea of voluntary referrals for the European Court of Justice, and the latest kind of UK proposals on the Irish border. I think in the days after that lunch, we'll have a pretty good idea whether the UK is going to get sufficient progress or not. This isn't going to be decided on the night at the council. It's all going to be worked out in advance. I mean, if she can get, I mean, the view in Downing Street, and I think this is probably right, that if she can get to trade and transition, it will be the kind of equivalent of a kind of political adrenaline shot for her. It will make her more powerful than she's been since the election. And I think they'll then do a kind of reshuffle soon after that to kind of try and reinforce this new sense of authority.
But is there any possibility that these talks could break down?
Oh yeah, sure, there's a possibility, though, as James says, they tend to be rigged in advance. And right now, there's optimism in Brussels, there's optimism in London. There's also a feeling that if Theresa May was told she hasn't passed the test, the pressure on her to walk away from the talks completely would be quite significant. So I think that both sides realise that this Davis and Barnier show has gone on for about as long as it reasonably could, and it's time to bring it to a close. I mean, what I understand Theresa May did here was that she reached out to Paris, reached out to Berlin with this financial offer, and if they were willing to accept it, then they'd give it to Barnier, but they wouldn't go through this drama yet again. So this does give her an achievement, which is a pretty rare thing for her this year, and also perhaps might allow her to talk about things other than Brexit, because so far, everything since the election has seemed like one long spanking session where Barnier takes out his cricket bat and beats some Brits.
I think it is worth remembering that the next election...
Sorry, was spanking the wrong word.
The vis anglais, I think, is an appalling schoolboy friend has it. I think they rather think we rather enjoy it. No, I think it is worth remembering that at the next election, it won't be Theresa May leading the Tories into it. And so this is this question, which is that those Tories who want to argue the glass is half full will say, look at all the things we've done wrong, and yet we're still essentially level in the polls. That suggests a certain public resistance to Corbyn. Let Brexit passions cool. get a new leader and you can see how things work. Someone pointed out to me the other day that Harold Macmillan is quite a good example of this. He's the third Tory Prime Minister in a row. He becomes Prime Minister after the Tories have already been in office for 5.5 years. Everyone is saying they're tired. And the party has been fundamentally split over Suez. And in some ways, the divisions over Suez were even more bitter than the divisions over Brexit. Macmillan becomes Prime Minister, sets about reinvigorating the party and showing that, as he used to put it, life is better under the Conservatives. And 2 years later, he substantially increases the party's majority. I think it can be done. But I think if they're going to do it, they've got to take another leaf out of Macmillan's book and build more houses.
Fraser, how big a threat is Corbyn at this stage?
Oh, a pretty significant threat. I mean, remember, the Conservatives still have no real idea how strong its support is. What they saw as a political virus that's taken over the Labour Party now seems to have infected a significant chunk of the electorate. We don't know if this Corbyn mania is a fashion that might cool in 2 or 3 years. We don't even know if they'll be able to last 2 or 3 years, because the government might not, with its majority being non-existent. So I think he focuses Tory minds, though, because they might disagree about a lot, but what they can agree on is that there is a real danger of Jeremy Corbyn getting into number 10. They ought to agree. And so often, recently, when I've been talking to government ministers about the future, they end the conversation by saying, well, I might disagree with so-and-so about Brexit, about tax cuts, but if we don't agree, Corbyn's going to get in. So I think that the reality of the Corbyn threat will focus Tory minds. The question is, when will they get it together as a party? I would have thought that they would have done so before now, to be honest, but maybe they had to wait for this Brexit hurdle to be crossed.
James, you start off your column with a question, so let's end on that, which is, how will the party remember 2017? How do you think the Tories will remember 2017?
I think, as I say in the column, there are two ways. It could either be the year when they lost their majority, alienated key sections of the electorate and kind of paved the way for a Corbyn premiership. It could be seen almost as the kind of most disastrous year in the party's modern history. Or it could be seen as the year in which uncertainty about Britain's future relationship with the EU peaked, that debt finally began to fall, and the Tories kind of resisted a Cornwall-style split. Indeed, to touch on Fraser's point, I think if Labour was led by a more anodyne figure than Jeremy Corbyn, someone kind of more middle of the road, I think the Tories probably would have split over Brexit. I think what is holding them together is the fact that the change that Corbyn would bring to the economy is almost even more fundamental than the changes brought about by leaving the single market and the customs union. And that is what keeping those Tories who can hold dearly to the EU from abandoning the party full stop, is the fact that their fear is they wouldn't stop Brexit and they get a Corbyn Brexit, which would be the kind of, to them, the worst of all possible worlds.
Fraser, how do you think the Tories will remember this year?
As the year where they as a party succumbed to extreme hubris in the form of calling a needless early election, took the electorate for granted and were reminded that you can't do that nowadays, and then suffered a near-death experience. The question is whether they recover from that, and we'll find out in 2018.
Thank you, James, and thank you, Fraser. And finally, in this week's issue, Peter Hitchens laments the loss of Britain's small rail lines. He joins me now, along with the railway historian Christian Wolmar, the author of Railways of the Raj. So, Peter, you start your piece with a eulogy for a railway line which no longer exists. Can you tell us about it?
Oh, it's the old Cambridge to Oxford line, which I used to take when I was at school in Cambridge and lived in Oxford in the 1960s, knowing that it was doomed. You could tell just from looking at it. And I'd seen so many railways close around me by then that I was fairly sure that it had been given the black spot by somebody, and then it just did close. But it was a wonderfully picturesque and ancient thing. It was diesel-hauled. It wasn't particularly old-fashioned in that way. But it just rambled and potted and shuddered through some completely unspoilt and quiet parts of England, which now you couldn't reach, really. And if you did reach them by car, you'd ruin them by getting to them. The great thing about railways in the countryside was that they were a way of the modern world mixing with the ancient world without spoiling it. And that's something we've completely lost.
A line between Cambridge and Oxford seems quite a good route. Why was it shut down?
Nobody knows. The hated Dr. Beeching, who was himself the handmaiden of the ghastly Ernest Marples, didn't actually recommend closing it in his notorious report. Harold Wilson just shut it, and nobody really knows why. Obviously, it didn't make any money, but almost no railways make any money, and it was one of the very few lines that ran from east to west. And it would, if it had been kept, have been tremendously useful for goods and passengers alike, for routing them around London. And it's not that it's closed to passengers now. Since privatisation, large chunks of it seem more or less to have evaporated. I don't quite know how it is that long lengths of steel track have ceased to be there, but they don't seem to be there anymore when I go and look at it.
Christian, do you also lament the decline of Britain's small railways?
Well, yes and no. Yes, of course, there's a lot of lines that shouldn't have been closed. Some would inevitably have been closed because they really were completely uneconomic and, you know, seven people and a dog might have used them in a week. But I'm not quite as depressed about the state of the railways as Peter, because I went to Glasgow by train yesterday, up on the West Coast Main Line and down on the East Coast. And, you know, it's still a wonderful experience. And the views you get once you get north of Preston are absolutely fabulous. And, you know, it is the most wonderful way to travel. And if I'd had time, I could have dodged via Barrow and Workington and gone along the Cumbria line, which is by the sea and has some spectacular views. So it's not all lost, Peter.
It's not all lost. No, around where I live in Oxford, for instance, you've got several handsome, pleasant market towns. I'm thinking of Tame and Witney and Wantage and Abingdon, all of which were connected to the railways before Beeching, and you could live in them and you could start a journey on the railway and you could end your journey somewhere else equally picturesque on the railway without having to get into a car. But once all these little parts were lopped off, people decided if they were going to start their journey by car, they might as well finish it. And Beeching's whole nonsensical idea was that you could keep the economical lines open and apply the same logic to our nationalised road system. You'd close all the Acacia Avenues and huge numbers of B roads, because they'll never make any money, and concentrate on the big toll roads, and everything else would be cart tracks. It's obviously moronic, both in a business and economic way, but people accept it blindly as if it made sense.
No, I mean, I quite agree that there were lines that should not have been closed. Certainly Oxford, Cambridge, which he didn't actually, as you say, recommend, should never have been closed, nor should the great central line, which would basically could have been transformed into an HS2.
Well, it was built to continental gauge, so trains from Germany and France could have run on it. It was the only railway in Britain, and they just closed it.
Bang. Absolutely, but you must admit that some of the village-to-village lines, I mean, if you look at a map in my book, Fire and Steam, where I had a map of Scotland, Scottish railways in the northeast of Scotland, and there's a whole lot of lines north of Aberdeen, that, which would, of course, be wonderful to travel upon now, but you know, nobody much lives there, and they really weren't economic. So some of those lines had to go.
You're talking about Scotland, but if you look at the home counties, people keep saying how rural life has become almost impossible if you have no car. And this is partly because bus services are completely subject to momentary withdrawal and just stop or don't run. Railway lines aren't like that. Once you've got them, they're there. I have to say that I think if the southeast of England still had a fairly close web of country branch lines, they'd be very much used these days by people who like to live in the country and work in the city. The fact they're not there makes country life and the countryside less pleasant.
No, I agree with that.
Look at the traffic on B roads in the countryside. It's incredibly heavy now, and so much of that could go by train.
And there's certain branch lines which have been preserved by heritage railways, which certainly should be reopened. There was an item on the Radio 4 yesterday about people in Minehead and how they couldn't get access to jobs. Now, there's a perfectly good railway there that runs from Minehead to almost to Taunton. It isn't quite connected. And that could serve as a wonderful
I think that was one of the ones that John Betjeman rode on in its last days. But here's the interesting thing to me. I'm a political, social and moral conservative. I can't understand why so many of my fellow conservatives seem to think that roads are conservative and railways are socialist. Railways ought to be nationalised, in my view, but roads are nationalised. They are a huge nationalised industry. And in the United States, it was Eisenhower's nationalising of the interstates and putting state money behind them, which destroyed the private railroads in the United States. Why is it that conservatives are so against railways? I don't get it.
Well, unlike you, Peter, as you probably know, I'm of the other political
exactly.
persuasion.
That's why I brought it up.
And,
but you both agree that it should be nationalised, is that?
I think we do, yes. But it's quite a difficult job to actually renationalise some parts of it, but they don't make sense. The actual key point is, as well as being renationalised, they should be reintegrated. You shouldn't have this network rail thing and the train operators thing, and then the rolling stock is owned by another lot of people, and the engineer is done by a fourth lot. That is completely
nobody's
insane.
Responsible for anything. I think there are some things which the state runs better than private enterprise does, and there's nothing unconservative about that, because apart from anything else, the effect of building motorways and roads on countryside and indeed on cities, is destructive of the things which conservatives like. The settled, the local, the particular, the old, the things which are valuable because they've been there a long time. They're what's swept away by the Red Revolution. And I've never understood why more conservatives don't take the position that railways are worth preserving.
Kristen, can I ask you, you mentioned going up and down on the railway, and Peter says that the Varsity Line was one of the few that went east to west. Why do we have so many railways that go vertically but not laterally across the country?
That's because, you know, London was always the centre to get to. The railway company that didn't have a line to London built one. I mean, St Pancras, for example, was built quite late in the railway age because the Midland Railway was desperate to get a link to London. That was seen as their economic profitable lines. And that's why we have fewer services that circumvent London, which is a great loss. France is just like us, but Germany is completely different, where they actually have no centre of their rail network and link all the cities. Well,
Germany
very
has no
well.
Equivalent of London, then, does it? It has it.
It does. That's why. Yes.
Berlin isn't really the equivalent of London, and the major cities are more important. When one looks at the announcement that was made on Tuesday night, it must have been again claiming they were going to reverse Beeching cuts. One of the other things I saw, another line I used to travel on, very beautiful line, which used to run up from Exeter round the top side of Dartmoor to Plymouth. Why was it closed in the first place? Every few years, the other line to the southwest is washed away at Dawlish, and they have no way of getting round. And it was obviously sensible to keep it, and yet they just shut it. And what was this mania that went through the British establishment in the early 60s which caused this?
Well, it goes deeper than that. When the railways were created as four big companies in 1923, we also got for the first time a department for transport, a transport ministry. And right from the start, it was staffed with about a dozen people who dealt with the railways and about 90 or 100 who dealt with the roads. And there was always this concentration. The car was the future. And nobody ever worked out that the more cars you get, the less good it will be for each additional car user because the congestion will be greater. And Beeching happened at just the time when the belief in car was greatest. And therefore that everything could be solved. Motorways were being built at the time, and therefore the car was seen as the solution. And of course, we know now, and you know, we are now investing in the railways, massive amounts. We know now that, you know, having just cars as your main form of transport just doesn't work.
Do you think there was a Marple scandal as big as the Profumo scandal and people just haven't heard about it? I tend to think that that era was particularly shocking in our national
history. Marples was certainly very... Of course, he had Marples Ridgeway. He built motorways. And I think there was something of a conspiracy. There's been some books on this by Chris Austin and Lord Faulkner, who've written a series of books about this period, and there is definitely elements of a conspiracy between the roads lobby, ministers and civil servants who disliked the railways. They thought, you know, they were awful. They would drive. Remember, Horse Guards Parade, where we're talking near here, used to be a car park for the civil servants, right? No, it really was.
I remember it well.
They made a lot of fuss when it was taken because all the civil servants thought they could drive into central London.
And the fascinating thing about Ernest Marples, who was the Minister of Transport who commissioned Beeching to wreck the railways, was that he ended his career by skipping the country, which is one of the least known political scandals of our age. I wish someone would actually revive it.
Well, somebody did ask me to write a book on Marples, and I might do that.
I think you should. I think this is... oddly enough, he fled the country by train on the old on the old night ferry, where he could load as much of his worldly goods as he could get into the guards van, and left his flat in Belgravia empty, and then went off and hid in a chateau in Beaujolais for the rest of his life. And it's one of the most astonishing stories and one of the least known about British politics in the post-war era.
Thank you, Peter, and thank you, Christian. That's all for this week. You can subscribe to the podcast on the iTunes store or by visiting spectator.co.uk/podcast. And you can also subscribe to our other shows, including Americano, our American politics podcast, hosted by Freddie Gray. And if you enjoy the podcast, why not pick up the magazine? You can read all the features discussed, as well as great pieces by Melanie McDonough, David Trimble and Elisa Seagrave. And we've got a special offer. You can get 12 issues for just £12, as well as a limited edition Spectator Moleskine notebook if you subscribe at spectator.co.uk/podoffer. Thanks for listening, and do join us again next week.